Coming up on Tech Nation, Sharon Vosmick, the CEO of Astia, providing capital connections and guidance to fuel the growth of highly innovative women-led ventures around the globe. Actually, both men and women lead these organizations, and we learn about women fatigue. Then on Biotech Nation, the first of a two-part series on women in biotech venture capital. Today it's Dr. Marianne DeBacker, the Vice President for Johnson & Johnson Innovation, Janssen Business Development. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Nobody argues that their baby shouldn't have a birth certificate. Well, okay, some people do, but the hassle of not having one in today's world is generally unworkable. Want to prove your citizenship? Enter school. Get a passport. Government-issued birth certificates have been accepted for decades, although baptismal certificates were once more frequently used. And then there was the lugging in of the family Bible. In pointing to each baby's name and birth date, carefully written inside the front cover. When people didn't move around much and the technology didn't exist, this worked just fine. Something similar happened with Social Security numbers. When President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law in 1935, the concept was to track people based on who would benefit. And thus my grandfather and grandmother shared a single Social Security number. You see, he worked at a job, and she was a housewife. Just seemed right to the designers of the system. Both of them would be benefiting from the contributions that my grandfather made as part of his employment. The idea of registering every newborn baby? I would venture to say they would find it laughable. In my generation, you didn't get a Social Security number until you applied for your first official non-cash job or you went to college. Many of us, myself included, made up a Social Security number on a form or two just to keep the process rolling. If you didn't have one, you had to apply in person and wait. And if you did have one, you'd have to find your card and then write it down. You didn't use it very much because it said very clearly, right on the card, not to be used for identification purposes. Pretty funny, since the point of the number was identification purposes, but you get the drift. Don't flash it around as an essential source of identification. When my firstborn came along, a generous grandparent with a career as a stockbroker thought the lad should start out life with some stock of his own. So we had to get him a Social Security number. And how did we do it? I held up the baby and my husband took a photo. We got the film developed and we sent it into the Social Security office. I mean, really? A bald, nondescript baby? And I have to be in the picture, or so I was told? Well, he's used it ever since, and no doubt it is ensconced in any number of databases. Today, some 90% of U.S. parents obtain a Social Security number for their baby at birth, and it's a regular part of the standard birth registration process. Social Security calls this EAB, which stands for Enumeration at Birth. At least they got that part right. It's enumeration. They're assigning your baby a number. And no matter how you might feel about it, it's part of the modern world. While 9 out of 10 American babies will likely think of it as the air, it's just there. But before you worry about it, if history and the arc of technology bear out, the current state of things is only a blip on the screen. You see, when it comes to biotech, there's DNA. And when a baby pops out, well, heck, There's his or her DNA right there, the ultimate identifier. In the future, the idea of being assigned a number to track you will seem incredibly archaic. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, the CEO of Astia, providing capital, connections, and guidance to fuel the growth of highly innovative women-led ventures around the world. Turns out it's both men and women. Then on Biotech Nation, the first of a two-part series on women in biotech venture capital. Today it's Dr. Marianne DeBacker, the Vice President for Johnson & Johnson Innovation, Janssen Business Development. Prior to speaking with Sharon Vosmick, the CEO of Astia, I reviewed Astia's white paper, and two headlines hit me. The first was, social ideas of what men do and what women do have changed. And the second, it read, the fact is, women are not from Venus. We're not?
We certainly have found that in the space that we focus on, which is innovation, men and women are more alike than they are different. I think that the most notable and important thing to contemplate is specifically within entrepreneurship. As an entrepreneur, there are some key indicators of success. And interestingly, they're identical between men and women. The average age of a successful entrepreneur, 40 years old. For a woman, 38 for a man. Average number of children, 2. Average motivators for becoming an entrepreneur, almost identical. Usually has to do with some degree of independence, a vision for the future, and a desire to make a change. Interestingly as well is that their success trajectory is really the only thing that makes them different. In other words, the investor is the one with the problem. And it's not that men and women somehow have different tolerances of risk or different approaches to entrepreneurship. So we need to start talking about the pipeline problem. As investors, we need to start looking at our investment problem and see what we can do and what the opportunities are and how to move the bar.
Now, I've known about Astia for 15 years. Describe what it was in the beginning and what it has grown to today.
I actually really enjoy telling the story of Astia because we are a highly innovative global organization that has evolved over the years, to your point. We were originally founded by Kate Muther here in Silicon Valley. Kate was an entrepreneur out of Cisco, and she took a look around the valley and saw that only 2% of venture capital at that time was being invested in women CEOs. So she started what was then called the Women's Technology Cluster. The Women's Technology Cluster was a phenomenal organization that was a physical incubator south of Market before South of Market was cool. And it focused
but it really had cheap rent.
Very cheap rent.
I remember this.
Yes. But what was really exciting about the incubator model was it was early days for incubation as a model to really help entrepreneurs grow their businesses, raise capital, and succeed. And the Women's Technology Cluster was right there, early days, participating and driving forward the success of the companies that qualified to participate. Over the years, Stanford, under the leadership of Professor Tom Kosnick, wrote a number of business cases about Astia. And what we learned through those business cases was really important to our shifts in business focus. First, we learned, very interestingly, that space was not the differentiator for these companies. So a physical incubator was not the offering that they needed. What they needed was access to networks. So over the years, in 2005, we stopped offering a physical space. A very important key learning in 2007 was that by having women first in the name, we were actually causing a bit of gender fatigue. We both had a messaging problem because women first belied the fact that half of our community was men. but also the actual physical and emotional reaction to it. You can see people physically withdraw as you use the words, the women's technology cluster. And then their emotional reaction to it was what led the conversation. So we rebranded as Astia. At the same time, we embraced our global vision, really understanding that where women entrepreneurs succeed, they have access to a global network. And this has to do with a number of social issues. Locally, we're defined by women very differently than we are globally. Locally, we are wives, we are mothers, we are caretakers. Globally, we're allowed to compete in the market. And it's very important that our entrepreneurs have access to global networks that validate them as entrepreneurs, that value them as leaders, and that invest in them. And so becoming a global organization over the years was very logical and part of our journey. And I think, really importantly, grounded in learnings from Professor Kosmic's work.
Well, today you have nodes in Silicon Valley, in London, New York. If we look at your board of trustees, your board of advisors, we have a world map of where investors are and where innovation is.
We truly do. And it was never more so poignant to me than just this past June. We spoke at a conference in Dublin called InspireFest. It's done by this phenomenal woman, Anne O'Day. I'll do a shameless plug for Anne. And we knew that we wanted to be there. We had gone the year prior, heard from amazing innovators, most of them women. And we knew this conference was really at the bleeding edge of innovation and women's voices within innovation. And we invited and opened up through our network that we're going to be there. Come join us. We had 14 of our 50 ASTI Angels members fly in from around the globe. We had another 10 ASTI advisors fly in from around the globe. And while the full conference was over 4,000 individuals, our representation was pretty powerful when you look at the checks we write and the borders we cross to write those checks. So it was an exciting validation that we are truly global. We'll get on an airplane to meet with an entrepreneur, and we're okay if they're not sitting right here in Silicon Valley in our backyard.
Now we have Astia Access, Astia Angels, and Astia Funds. In any order, because you got to talk about them all together. What are they?
Yeah. Let's start with ASTI Access, because it's what people know most about us. Over our 15 years, what we really perfected was ensuring that companies that had women on the founding team could access capital. Capital, regardless of if it was ours or the broader investor ecosystems, we were able to source, screen, and select the best-in-class companies to show to the investment ecosystem. And for that work, we continue to see an unparalleled success rate. 60% of those companies secure funding within 1 year of going through our access program. They continue to gain access to advisors. We make over 40 advisor connections a month for the companies who apply to Astia. And it continues to be really our hallmark in building relationships with entrepreneurs. We have over 5,000 advisors around the globe who are continually touching innovators, encouraging them to join the ASTI community, learn from us, grow with us, and then allow us to invest. And that's ASTI Access. Consider it the relationship turbocharged by a global community of over 5,000 individuals.
This isn't just come in and get some help. You have to apply. You're screened.
Yeah. It's a highly selective process. Having said that, we're taking a look at over 40 companies a month at a very deep level. In other words, I want to highlight there is no shortage of opportunities to look at. And I want to highlight this for the investment community, because the next group you asked about was ASTI Angels and why we launched ASTI Angels. We were seeing this abundance in deal flow. And we were seeing these companies succeed that were coming through ASTI Access. But we weren't getting to participate. And most notably, at year 10, our 10th anniversary, we also noticed that still in that year, 2010 at the time, 2% of venture capital was still going to women CEOs. So in our 10-year journey, the market had not moved.
The needle hadn't moved.
Not even a bit. And now people will argue over if it's 2% or 3%. You're still not waking me
we
up.
We don't get out of bed for this.
Exactly. No, not no, getting no, me out of no, bed no. for that one. But I thought what was really important was that our community raised their hand and says, this isn't moving. Sandhill Road is not moving. So let's move it ourselves. Create an angel network that we can rally around and collectively invest in these companies ourselves. And it took us about 2.5 years of what I'd call market research and really important community validation, because we were founded on a mission and vision of that mission. We wanted to be true to the community and honor its contributions as volunteers to these companies. And what we heard back was a resounding do it. So we launched Ask the Angels, originally in Silicon Valley. Within 1 year, we had rolled out a New York membership, Boston, and the East Coast corridor. And then the following year, we rolled out Ask the Angels in London. We now, as I mentioned, have 50 investors. And those investors are Silicon Valley. We see that they're primarily serial entrepreneurs who have been there, done that, have had their success, and want to write checks. The East Coast membership tends to be what I'd call later stage investors, folks out of private equity, public markets, but still wanting to invest in innovation. So they join Ask the Angels in order to do their direct investing. And then London is primarily family offices and large, ultra high net worth individuals who have a real passion for innovation and a desire to directly engage with entrepreneurs. So the universal or binding thesis behind all of them is that they believe in women as innovators. They want to invest in that innovation personally and directly, and they want to do it in concert with the efforts of other individuals who are aligned around those key theses.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Sharon Vosmek. She's the CEO of Astia, a multifaceted organization providing capital, connections, and guidance to fuel the growth of highly innovative women-led ventures around the globe. Now, before we get to the funds, let's back up just slightly and say these aren't about all women led or women managed. You, and I'm quoting from your website here, embrace a vision of inclusive female male top teams as an investment strategy, not just women.
We do. And it kind of goes back to how we focus on research for the things we do. We really like to get at not just the data, but the subsequent conclusions, that, if any, that can be found. And I think that that's a real differentiator for Astia. We not only know the data, we then actually process it and apply those learnings. And there is a professor out of MIT, Professor Malone, Thomas Malone, who did some great research on group intelligence. He had set out to measure if there could be a group IQ. We knew individual IQ. We've been using it for the last 40-plus years to great success. What he wanted to show was, were there group measures of IQ, and could that measure the likelihood of a group's success as it translates to innovation? And the really exciting thing is, yes, you can measure group IQ, and yes, you can actually predict the success of groups if you monitor for three really core behaviors within those groups. And so at Astia, we focus on those three core behaviors with the teams we invest in. Number one, how well do the groups dialogue? Do they argue versus converse? Are they argumentative and aggressive, or are they thoughtful and engaging? And this matters to group IQ. Number two, we learned from Professor Malone's research that the group needed to interpret each other's body language. How well could they actually understand the unsaid within the group? And could they call out dialogue when it wasn't happening? And this is a behavior of empathy, one might say, and a behavior that leads to higher group intelligence, we learned. And then the third was how many women on the team. Now, what's interesting about the third is that I do think a case could be made that we socialize young women to do points one and two that I covered that lead to higher group intelligence. Okay, we do. So let's count the women on the team, because women happen to have better socialized skills as it relates to higher group performance and group intelligence. But you'll note I didn't say absolutely all women. I actually described a behavior on a team, two sets of behaviors, and then a variable, the number of women. We take all of that into consideration. So we want there to be women on the executive team along with men, because we know it leads to higher group intelligence because of the way they perform, the way they dialogue, and the way they engage each other in the innovation as they take it to market. We're real believers in inclusion. And we don't think that women only in any way approaches the success we achieve. We seek to achieve. We seek higher returns, and we seek to change the world. And both of those require both men and women present.
Now, we've had the Astia Access, which means you've been through some screening, and let's talk about that. Astia Angels, we haven't talked about the Astia Funds. Maybe we could do that in, if I'm a great company and I come to Astia, take us through that, and when might we see those three?
So that's a great question, because I do find that corporates should be asking that. How can they gain exposure? It's interesting how few of them do. I think if I might digress for a moment and talk about why they should care about this and then take them through. If we've looked at the journey of women joining the workforce, I think we'd all have to agree that nothing has changed in the last 30 years. There was a phenomenal first journey thanks to powerful women who really broke some tough ceilings, and good for them. But then after that, the subsequent organizational changes did not occur. And we see low numbers of women in what I'll call the invitation-only clubs, the boardroom, the executive suite, those places that I think, and actually research shows, so it really doesn't matter what I think, but higher business performance, higher return for investors is seen when women are present in those invitation-only rooms. So I look at our 30-year journey and say women are half of the educated, half of the PhDs, half of the MBAs, half of the MDs. Why is it that we're only some small percentage of the executives and board members? I think we have to acknowledge that the programs we've designed to achieve parity for women in those spaces haven't worked. And at Astia, we have something different that is working. First and foremost, the fastest way to a boardroom is as an entrepreneur. You found your company.
You're on the board.
You have just joined a board. Exactly.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
Let's not wait the 70 years for
you
parity.
You want to be the boss? Find out the company.
Exactly. You want to join the executive suite? Found a company, and you are in the executive suite. It's really powerful to look at entrepreneurship as a means of social change. And it is a phenomenal opportunity for women broadly to achieve parity. But then for corporations who are looking for solutions that they haven't yet found themselves, engaging with entrepreneurs who have found a way to include women in boardrooms, women in executive suites, it's a great place for corporations to be looking, quite honestly, not just for innovation, but also for inclusion. So then you ask the question of how do they engage? So ASTI Access is a great place for corporations to get early visibility to disruptors within their own sector. You think of fintech, the best time to see an early stage disruptor is well before you want to buy anything from them, well before you want to invest in them. Because what you want to do ideally is build relationship so that they can understand your business needs and you can understand their potential.
And not everyone knows what fintech is.
Thank you. Financial tech. So those innovators who are taking on the big banks, who struggle to innovate for lack of resources focused on innovation for a lot of reasons. And what's exciting for I think, all entrepreneurs is you can innovate across all these exciting sectors, but you still have to have relationships into the large corporations so that you can understand regulations, you can understand their customer pressure points, and so that you can really directly address their needs as you grow and scale your business.
Tell us about the scope of the sectors and then take us through.
I actually really get excited talking about the Astia Angels portfolio because I think everyone expects it to be pink, expects it to be very consumer heavy. But if we could just go through the percentages, I love to talk about the portfolio. So we are almost 50% tech invested. When I say tech, I mean hard tech. We have hardware, we have software, we have SaaS, we have enterprise solutions, we have direct-to-consumer software products. And that tech is very exciting for its diversity of teams, its diversity of approaches, its diversity of business model. They are innovating on all fronts. It's very exciting. Then we have a lovely representation of med device and health and wellness. Med device, we're just over 20% invested in med device. And I think it's notable because the med device solutions that we've invested in address areas that were either overlooked or poorly addressed. And so real disruption was needed. And I'll give an example of our first investment ever by Astia Angels was in a company called Envision. Envision is a medical device company that focused on women's reproductive health. solutions. And in particular, they have a device for the harvesting of cells and diagnosing of cervical cancer. As you know, Moira, this is a very dangerous cancer, deadly cancer, and early detection is critical. And Surbhi Sarna, who is the CEO and founder of that company, has managed to progress through her FDA clearance and is now getting geared up to begin the commercialization process of a product that is transformational for women everywhere. So these are very exciting innovations that we've invested in. The final portfolio I'd round out is health and wellness is broadly more consumer health and wellness. We have just over 15% there. And then we have that consumer part, which is everyone expects us to have a very large consumer part. It's just over 10%. So the portfolio is beautifully diverse in sector. It's beautifully diverse in their solutions. They're diverse in their teams. We have it beautifully covered across all of these really important elements for investors.
So I have an enterprise here. It's a small enterprise. I'm getting going. I know I need connections. I need money. I need advice. I need everything. Okay, so I come to Astia. What's the first step? How do I make it across the first line?
Well, I always say that the first line is relationship-based. A best way to come to Astia is by finding an Astia person and building a relationship. Now, we also don't want that to prevent anyone from finding us. So you can come to Astia and apply. But the reason I emphasize the relationship piece is that ultimately is what is needed to succeed. The individual does not scale in these
Anywhere, in all of business. Astia, not Astia.
Exactly. And we have over 5,000 folks around the globe. If you can't find someone who's in some way affiliated with Astia, you should set out to do so. But having said that, that shouldn't prevent you from finding us. We have a website, astia.org. You can go to it as an entrepreneur and apply. The application is no small task, and it's intentionally so. We're looking for people who are very serious about growing their businesses to scale, who are seeking innovation that is disruptive and that is addressing a real need. I also think as I look across the portfolio that it's important for me to highlight that some of the products are doing things that are true game changers in industries that haven't been innovated on in hundreds of years. We have one in the UK. It's called Ozo Innovations, and it's disrupting butchery and food handling through a water process that is just very exciting. And when we were diligencing the company and talking to their customers who were butchers and food handlers, and we heard their enthusiasm for the product that was innovation in their space that had not seen innovation in probably 40 to 60 years. That was exciting. And that's what these companies are doing and achieving.
I'm speaking with Sharon Vosmick, the CEO of Astia, providing capital, connections, and guidance to women-led ventures around the globe. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, the first of a two-part series on women in biotech venture capital. Today, it's Dr. Marianne DeBacker from Johnson & Johnson Innovation. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Sharon Vosmick, the CEO of Ostia, a multifaceted organization providing capital, connections, and guidance to women-led ventures globally.
You don't focus on the single. Instead, I think you have a more broad perspective as you approach the market, and you define the problem set, I think, more broadly, and you come up with really interesting approaches to existing problems.
So you make it past the criteria screen. Now you go to the industry screen, and they're like, okay, well, how big is this industry? Where were we talking here? And one of the things, one of the elements of that that I particularly like is the term defensible advantage. So many times when I talk to people about their enterprise or what they want to do or what they're doing, they'll throw out a set of advantages. It could be a function. It could be a quality. It could be and then they're not defending it. They're not providing a rationale for why this is an advantage. And making people go through that is it's you're doing them a favor.
Yeah.
It's not an advantage if you can't defend it.
What you're describing is what we call our Astia expert sift. And we do believe it's a powerful differentiator. We're not four folks around a table making a decision about a company. We actually, as you highlighted, reach out to industry experts to ask for feedback on real market components. What is the current state of the market as we think about this company? And how is this company seeking to address that market? Is the market potential growing or shrinking? And is the appetite for innovation in that market there? These are really important questions that entrepreneurs have trouble getting direct access to answers, mostly because they're pre-customers. So getting feedback from market is critical. And so in our 15-year journey, as we evolved as an organization, we curated this global community to help us find best-in-class companies. And along the way, what they do is provide feedback that we hear is often the first direct feedback these entrepreneurs have received. They're out there in the market thinking everyone's loving them. And what they're able to learn through us is, yes, we love you, and.
Or the venture capitalists just say no, and they don't tell them why.
Exactly.
And so they go on to the next one with the same pitch, and they say no again. So this is a real partnership here. This is that's really important. Who wants to waste time?
And it's powered so generously. Astia, I will remind you, we were founded 15 years ago with a very clear mission. We are a nonprofit organization for a reason. There are a community of individuals who really believe in this work. And they believe in it because they know it's what takes getting innovation to market. True innovation does not flow easily into a commercialization state. Right? You have to actually learn and adjust to market conditions, and you have to hear from customers, and you have to engage customers. And so our expert sift is our effort to bring that to bear for these companies in a very efficient way. It is just-in-time advice.
Now, you made it past the criteria. You got through the industry screen. Now they're like, okay, let's look at this operations screen. What's that about?
I love our operations screens. We have them weekly, and they're actually live on WebEx. Thank you, very generously hosted by Cisco. And those WebExes are phenomenal. We have two companies present to, on average, 20 to 25 individuals who are been there, done that entrepreneurs. They've run businesses, and we do it across sectors because, interestingly, there are phenomenal learnings across sectors to be had. So the companies will present a modified investor presentation. It really is to focus on the operational components of their business, the team, the go-to-market strategy, and the approach that they're taking to getting this innovation to market. And on that WebEx, the company has 10 minutes to present its position, as it were. And then we move to this, I think, phenomenal Q&A. It's a dialogue between been there, done that entrepreneurs and the presenting entrepreneur.
And they're talking with each other as well.
And it's supportive and dynamic, and it is fully inclusive. Men and women on the call. So right there, we're breaking down all this social stuff of men and women being in separate business networks. We've created an ecosystem that includes men and women as peers, and they're engaging in business, and they're doing the business of growing innovation and taking it to market. We're not fixing women. We're not coaching women. We're not mentoring women. We're actually helping them run their businesses more effectively by engaging this expertise.
Now, you get through that. You're all set. We say, okay, Now you can get to the investor screen. What's that?
So this is where 6% of our companies make it to the investor screen. So this is tells you just how selective this process is.
It's tough.
But having said that, entrepreneurs out there who are listening, one rejection should never be taken. So you stay in the Astia Expert Sift as long as you want to, and you continue to get feedback and you continue to be asked to be reevaluated, because that's what we like to see, right? Entrepreneurs who take feedback, absorb it, move the business forward, and then continue to stay in touch with us. But let's say you make it on your first try to that investor screen. The Astia Angels are taking a very close look, if they haven't already, because Astia Angels can invest at anywhere along that pipeline. Their favorite time to invest, though, is after all of that feedback has been gathered, so that they can see how the company handled the feedback, engaged in the feedback, engaged with the broader advisor community, and grew the business through that process. And Astia Angels invest in 1%. So 6% companies make it through, and 1% of them secure investment from Astia Angels. So it's lovely, but not quite good enough. What do we do with the other companies that we know are qualified? We showcase them and make introductions. We used to host venture lunches in all of our markets, and that was our presenting companies to the investment community. We hosted them in Silicon Valley, in New York, in London. What we've learned about Silicon Valley is that investors will still not show up to see companies that have any language of inclusion or women on it. They continue to tell me that they don't have
there's this
women-led deals.
There's this step 3A saying, take women out of everything. Don't let them know. They don't have a need to know.
It's the most surreal thing. You know, I continue to read in the media that everyone's upset that more women aren't getting funding. But then to get investors to actually come see our companies has been brutal. And so we gave up on that, and we're just going with direct introductions now. And we make the introductions, and the companies continue to see the same funding success rate. In New York, we still host the venture lunches, and we hosted one in Dublin in June. So in other markets, we host them, bring in the investor community to see the companies. In Silicon Valley, we actually see, and this is for another topic for another day maybe, but Silicon Valley is still the hardest market for companies that include women and minorities. And on a daily basis, I am asked why that is. And I simply don't know. I think there's a theory I have. Stanford has done some good research around this to show that when you show someone research that directly confronts their mythology, they become more entrenched. And I think every time we show a successful company that has a woman at the helm, those who don't believe there are any successful women entrepreneurs become more firmly entrenched that they aren't any out there.
Well, there also is this invisibility factor. I could give you a number of instances from my own life, but I think my favorite one was we had some support from a global corporation that we will not actually identify at this point. But after a certain number of months of supporting us, they said, well, you know, you just don't have enough women on the show. And I went through and said, gee, we have, you know, a good 35-40% of our guests in tech and in biotech are women, you know, if you actually look at the numbers. And then I'm in the middle of this conversation, they're like, no, we wanted more. And I finally said, wait a minute, there's a woman on every show.
It was like, there you sit.
I wasn't
there
even counting me. You know, and it was like, oh, and it's like, well, we have another reason, you know. It's like, so there's this, you get to the top and there's, or you get to the, and then, okay, now we're not going to count you anymore. And it's like, ah.
Yeah, and this is part of the gender fatigue stuff too, is when you do women all, so all women, you end up with gender fatigue. If you do women included, nobody seems to count the women who are there. Or, and this was really interesting, when you hit 50-50, there's a really interesting thing, and it's happened enough times that as a sociologist, I'm going to say it's correlational enough that I'm going to say it's a reality, which is people are shocked by how many women and can't believe it's only 50%. So we have 50-50 on the Astia board, 50-50 in the Astia community, and 50-50 in most of our events. And yet most people will say, how did you find so many women? This is majority women.
And they're everywhere.
And it's interesting because I'll point out, actually, no, if you count exactly, it's half and half. Oh, no, there must be so many more women. And it's interesting how when you hit this half and half, there's this phenomena that suddenly that they think that 50% women is, whoa, too many. You have so many. That's overwhelming. And then the other thing you hit is a profound sense of discomfort. There are no corporate, political, business models where we have 50% men and 50% women, except for the military and what I'll call quota enhanced spaces. People are very uncomfortable when you actually hit 50-50. And maybe our work as organizations is to not seek to be comfortable with inclusion, but instead find that place where everyone's uncomfortable. Maybe that's what inclusion really is everybody's uncomfortable.
One thing I think is important about everything you've talked about, you know, throughout this interview is there's not one hint of how anyone should feel. It's how they do feel. It's rather surprising to see you note statistics and note observations that say, oh, yeah, this person, these people aren't comfortable, or we can't make inroads there, so we do it a different way, which is the entrepreneur's way. We don't care why you're not buying our product. What else can we do to have you buy it, and you're going to do it differently, and you over there are going to do it differently? I think that actually is a real game changer for anyone. It's like, okay, what do we do? Not how should you be. This isn't about delivering a message. This is about success.
And it's about action. Our call to action is invest today. If you're not up for that, if you don't want in on that, we're probably the wrong place for you. But if you're interested in investing today, we have some best-in-class companies. And this segues nicely to the Astia Fund. We look forward to be investing from it in Q1 of next year. The reality of why we need to create our own fund and why others won't do is that the market has not moved. So it is time to play with the big boys, as it were, and have a fund that can continue to do follow-on investing. Now, the exciting thing about Astia Angels is that we do early stage and follow-on. We actually have 38 companies in our portfolio, but that represents 51 investments. So we do follow-on, and I think Astia Angels is phenomenal because of that. It is, for an entrepreneur, a great journey for the business. But the truth is that venture funds are where the big game is in innovation. And venture funds are needed for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is that they are an indicator of a validator of a market that exists. And this market exists. There is an abundant deal flow at Astia. We're not able to do all the deals. As you heard me say, 6% make it through the sift and only 1% raise from Astia Angels. There's that 5% that we'd like to be able to address with the fund, quite honestly. And I think what's exciting about Astia is we're not going to waste our time with folks who aren't on board. We're going to get on with the business, invest today, and our portfolio is great validation that the opportunity is there.
Of course, today we have more women being investors, whether they're in traditional venture capital, they're angel investors because they themselves have been successful. Are they investing in the same way that men are?
So unfortunately, the reality for venture is that the number of women or the percentage of women who are general partners or those who are running the venture funds is flat. We still continue to see that fewer than, as I understand it, 8% of venture partners, the general partners who run the fund, are women. It's a really difficult number. Interestingly, over our 15-year journey, as that percentage has moved, it maps directly to the percentage of venture capital being invested in women CEOs. So when there were 10% female general partners in venture funds, we saw 10% of venture capital flowing into women CEOs. Now that it's down to 8%, we're back down to 8% going into women founders, 3% into women CEOs. It's very interesting to watch those correlations. But there's also unfortunate research out of Harvard that shows men and women investors behave equally poorly as it relates to gender blindness. They found that male or female investors were 64% more likely to invest in a white male, all other things being equal. So the entrepreneur presenting the exact same pitch, young man next to a young woman, investor, regardless of gender, is 64% more likely to invest in a white male. Heartbreaking statistics. But here's the good news, kind of going back to let's get on with it and invest. Simply by having women in the general partnership of a venture firm, some studies continue to show and have shown for the past 10 years that a venture fund is 75% more likely to have a woman in the portfolio if there is a woman general partner. And it's not that the woman is doing that investing. It's just that you have women within the peer structure. So the one could argue that it's not about women advocating for women. It's actually just women being present as peers. Men then evaluate women differently when they've seen a woman as peers, as a peer. It's why our model, I think, is so innovative and simple in its innovation. We're about men and women sitting side by side. Our Ask the Angels Network, men and women sitting side by side, assessing companies as peers, making investment decisions, and they experience women as the investor, women as the entrepreneur, women as the whatever part of the business, as the industry screener. And what they hear in that message is women are investor, industry screener, and entrepreneur.
Now, women have been a big part of philanthropy, and how they give has been studied, you know, very, very clearly. What's the relationship between philanthropy, if there is one, if we know one, and investing in innovation?
I think for women in particular, women investors, there's a very strong link. And we see that certainly within our Ask the Angels members and in the companies we subsequently invest in. Philanthropy, if we think about it, is our effort to fix whatever social ill we see. And I would argue that we are leading in a time, we as leaders are leading and investing in a time of some real challenges and problems globally, right? We have hunger, we have disease, we have poverty, we have major issues that require attention and focus. And one could argue you can do that best through philanthropy. I believe, through my own investing experience, that early stage investing pulls the same or fills the same need for me as my philanthropy. And I'll give one portfolio example. We have a company, RenovoRx, which is a medical device for the treatment of pancreatic cancer. And you know, pancreatic cancer is a deadly disease. If the patient doesn't die from the cancer, they tend to die from the treatment. And there are real concerns around the quality of life that any patient experiences with current treatment. Well, RenovoRx is a catheter that delivers the chemo directly to the pancreas. It's been inpatient for the past year. As a philanthropist, as a person seeking to make the world a better place, that investment resonated for me. And I made that investment, and Ask the Angels made that investment because we believe that the patient's current solutions are not acceptable, and we want to see something better. So we invest. And that's why I see them closely linked. It comes from the same place. That same desire to make a better world is what really is needed for an early stage investor. And this is my call to action for women philanthropists, because we are phenomenally philanthropic. Women control capital an order of magnitude above what we did even just 20 years ago. And what we do with that capital matters. If we keep it in philanthropy and only in philanthropy, that's like having only one tool in our toolkit. What's great is if we add to it in early stage investing, we can address the same social ills, but with multiple tools. We can have our philanthropy and we can have our investment, and they can sit side by side seeking to achieve the same goals and the same social cures.
Well, Sharon, such a pleasure. Please come back. Don't be a stranger.
I would love to come back. I look forward to updating you on all of our companies.
My guest today is Sharon Vosmek, the CEO of Astia, operating globally with nodes in Silicon Valley, New York, and London. More information is available on the web at astia.org. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, the first of a two-part series on women in biotech venture capital. Today we hear from Dr. Marianne DeBacker, the Vice President for Johnson & Johnson Innovation, Janssen Business Development. In the last year, she and her team looked at 170 opportunities and made 48 deals. I asked Dr. DeBacker, what's a deal?
A deal and deal making in biotech and pharm is really for different partners to bring together the resources they have to really develop either a treatment or a cure for a disease. And in my case, my team and myself, we're focusing really on trying to do partnerships in the area of infectious diseases and vaccines. And to give you one example, if we now want to develop a new cure for hepatitis C, we're actually bringing together three different drugs with three different mechanisms of actions and coming from three different companies from across the world together to make that drug. And so in a deal, we really, you know, discuss the terms and conditions under what we're going to do that. We're going to divide up who is going to do certain work in research, in development, how are the economics going to be divided. And it's all aiming at trying to find this, you know, new treatment or new cure for patients. It's a very rewarding thing to do, deal making in this space.
And yet, not only are these organizations interacting with you through Johnson & Johnson, you've got to make sure they're in complement with each other.
Yes, and that can really be sometimes very, very complex. And in infectious diseases in particular, what we typically need to do in order to develop a cure is that we need to bring different drugs together in a cocktail. And to do so, you need to bring different companies together because each of them holds, you know, a piece of the puzzle, so to speak. And it is, you know, it's almost an art to bring everyone together, having everyone comfortable that their value is recognized. And you have to realize a lot of these individual components come from biotech companies. It's those companies' babies, really, that we're trying
to... That's all they got.
Right, right. And they really want to make sure that, you know, it's going to be put to the best use. Now, what we try to do in our partnerships is really focus on, first of all, I mean, we're really here to make a benefit for patients. So we focus really on the product and what is the product, does it need to look like to be a success? And I think you can really rally, you know, partners around the idea of doing what's best for patients. And that's how we can get people comfortable in the end, I think, to, you know, all get together and work through sometimes, you know, hard processes to get it through development and hopefully eventually get it to patients.
Now, when is a collaboration successful and when not so much?
You know, if one of our products makes it to the market and
everybody,
you know,
loves it.
Everybody
loves it.
Doesn't
matter
that's
what
easy,
happened.
Right?
That's an easy one.
So that's really, really easy. And it's extremely rewarding for everyone involved if that happens. And you have to realize it doesn't happen that often, right? I mean, if you start a partnership very early on in preclinical, you only have 10% chance that your drug or your cocktail will get to patients, right? So if it happens, it's an absolute fantastic thing. We actually put a lot of emphasis on what we call alliance management. So as soon as we have entered into a partnership with a company, a partner, or different partners, we have people who do nothing else but focus on proactively making sure that the partnership is a success. So it's really trying to proactively, you know, see what problems could happen and trying to solve them before they occur. I think when partnerships are not working very well is, I think, if we are not all having that same goal of doing what's best for the product. And, you know, sometimes companies get torn into different directions, have different strategic intents. It's you really have to have that same common goal in trying to make that best possible product in the fastest way, you know, to patients.
Well, often the people who make the deal aren't the people that do the work.
Well, yes. So what we have actually established in our teams is that the people who, for example, manage the alliance post-signing, post-closing a partnership, they're also reporting into me. So, I mean, it's not like we close the deal and then it's hands off and, you know, there's nothing
left. They're still part of the whole.
Right, yeah. Right. So we are also held accountable to really help to make it a success. And I think that's important. You're absolutely right. Because, you know, once a partnership is closed, then the real work starts, right?
You were talking about infectious diseases. Are there any specifics in these collaborations with infectious diseases that are different from other kinds of deals?
Well, I think in infectious diseases, what is fantastic to see is that you have both treatments that, you know, can help to manage a disease. For example, HIV, you know, almost 40 million people died, it's now a manageable disease, at least in the Western world, right? And that's thanks to cocktails of drugs that were brought together. What you have also in infectious diseases is actually the ability to prevent infection, intercept in infection. So we have vaccines, obviously, which can prevent diseases from happening. Very important. And then in infectious diseases, we also were able to really cure a disease. So in hepatitis C, I mean, that was a deadly disease, right? People were developing liver cancer. Now there's cures for this disease. So it is an area where you can really see the whole spectrum from prevention, intercepting a disease, to treating it, and then to really potentially curing it. So you can really cover that whole spectrum. And it also means that you have to enter into a lot of different partnerships to be able to do that. Again, if you want to develop a cure for a virus, you really need to bring different mechanisms of actions and drugs together. And you can never do it on your own. You really have to be able to partner and partner effectively to be successful. And I think it is something that is going to be even more important in the future, because you see all this convergence happening between tech and biotech, and there's going to be more monitoring done of infections and self-monitoring by patients.
Part of this is the wearables we keep hearing about.
Absolutely. I mean, and also diagnostics. I mean, you can just offer one drop of blood and you can know whatever, you know, virus has ever infected you in your life. Of course, now with Zika and Ebola, very important to have these easy diagnostic tests, and they are available. And the same with wearables and monitoring. I mean, if we can monitor how things are going, we can maybe prevent diseases from happening, right? So I think also that our partnerships are going to be different in the future. What you see now is that we mainly partner with other pharma companies or other biotech companies, of course, a lot with funding organization and government organizations. But I think in the future, we will be partnering even more with tech companies who are in the space of, you know, developing apps and wearables and diagnostics and so on.
Well, Marianne, thank you so much for coming in. Please come back. See us again.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Dr. Marianne DeBakker is the Vice President for Johnson & Johnson Innovation, Janssen Business Development. More information about Johnson & Johnson's interest in pharmaceuticals, medical devices, and consumer products may be found on the web at jnjinnovation.com. Listen next week for the second part of our two-part series on women in biotech venture capital. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Anne Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.